Jambo.
Lessons from the screen, what we mean is we go through different documentaries to tell you what they gon' do. Give you our lessons, give them our blessings. If they trash, we tell you there is no second guessing. Knowledge is power, but time is precious, and we're here to keep you from them lessons. So sit back as we groove, giving you the review, so you only spend time on the docs that you need to.
Welcome to Lessons from the Screen, the show where we give you a review of whether or not any particular show that you can get or any particular information that you can get through any particular screen of any kind is worth your time. We waste our time, our energy, and our brain power so that you don't have to. Lessons from the Screen is sponsored by PAX Inc., a Black activist advocacy and think tank with the purpose of increasing the quality of life for Black people in America through education, a culture shift, and economics. Check them out at www.pactsinc.org. That's pactsinc.org. Volunteer, donate money, donate time, answer questions. Whatever floats your boat or finds your lost remote. Let's get it in. So, in September of 2016, students in Detroit decided that enough was enough. They filed a class action lawsuit against the state of Michigan, declaring that their fundamental rights were being violated on the basis of race. In addition to being taught in classrooms filled with rodents, insects, and mold, buildings with non-functioning AC, and in some cases being taught by other students because teachers weren't available, they had to contend with textbooks that were 20 years old and falling apart. And in addition to that, they didn't even have enough of those textbooks to go around. In the case, 5 schools were listed, 3 public schools and 2 charter schools, each with horrible ratings, representing the worst schools in the state. Going from a scale of 0 to 100, the schools are rated 1, 2, 4, and 6, one of the schools being closed. Less than 5% of the students at one school score proficient or above in the third grade, compared to 46% statewide, and that is proficient in English. At another school, 12.5% of students score proficient in English or above, compared with 49.2% statewide in the 11th grade. The schools lacked adequate teaching. And with one of those schools, they even went out of their way to recruit Latino children, non-English native speakers, telling them that they would provide English instruction, only to not have any teachers that could provide the service. So the students that knew English somewhat ended up helping the students that didn't know English at all. And that is completely separate from the case where an eighth grader was asked to teach seventh and eighth graders math for a month because they couldn't find a math teacher. And amidst all of this, Governor Richard Snyder appointed Darnell Early to administer the DPS schools, the Detroit Public Schools. This is significant because Darnell is largely blamed for the Flint water crisis. Now, it has to be mentioned here that he claims that the plan to switch to the Flint River was decided before he arrived, and what fell to him was to carry out the plan. So, you know, maybe he doesn't deserve the blame. Maybe he does. Who knows? There are people on all sides of that. But he does say that if you read the city documents, the city plan, that is in there, and that plan was created before he arrived. But back to the schools. With all that in mind, and after nearly 2 years of legal battles, Judge Stephen J. Murphy has made a ruling on the case. In this episode of Lessons from the Screen, we will be going over that ruling as well as some of the details of the case itself. As always, we will be giving some of the takeaways from the case. So stick around as we dig into literacy, a fundamental right. So this case basically breaks down to 5 points. Now, count 1 or point 1 is the alleged deprivation of a fundamental right under the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause. Now, the Due Process Clause is, well, basically, in Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, it says, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So that's basically what the due process clause is saying. That is it from the amendment. But it's basically stating that you cannot violate a person's rights without due process, without a procedure, without evaluating the rights and evaluating what you're doing to them. And that's typically what we have the judicial system for, is that evaluation standard. So it's basically, so what these this first count is alleging is that their fundamental rights were violated without due process, without anybody putting what was happening through any sort of process of evaluation and giving those that would be affected an opportunity to speak out against what was happening. It goes on to say decades of state disinvestment in and deliberate indifference to Detroit schools have denied plaintiff school children access to the most basic building block of education, literacy. Literacy is fundamental to participation in public and private life and is the core component of the American tradition of education. But by its actions and inactions, the state of Michigan's systemic, persistent, and deliberate failure to deliver instruction and tools essential for access to literacy in plaintiff schools, which serves almost exclusively low-income children of color, deprives students of even a fighting chance. The abysmal conditions and appalling outcomes in plaintiff schools are unprecedented, and they would be unthinkable in schools serving predominantly white, affluent student populations. In short, the schooling afforded to plaintiffs is both separate and unequal. And that's taken directly from the plaintiff's brief. And it basically says what it says. No need to decrypt that, because that's pretty plain. It feels like literacy is a fundamental right and that these children are being denied that right by these schools. Now, what can be elaborated on here is the reason they chose to sue the state is because the state has interceded in Detroit public school systems. Michigan has laws in place where if a school is deemed as failing, the state will take over a supervisory role in that school, in the management of that school, not necessarily in the operation of the school, but in the management of the school. And so over the years, over the last 20 years, Michigan has gotten so involved in Detroit public schools that a lot of the people in the schools feel like the state is directly responsible for what's happening now. I'm not here to argue whether they are or whether they are not. They will get into that in the case. But that does provide some clarity as to why they're choosing to sue the state instead of choosing to sue the city of Detroit. Now, count two is also under the due process clause, and it alleges that the defendants, as state actors, created or increased a danger. And this is where we're talking about the conditions of the schools physically, the actual buildings, in addition to at the elementary schools, the conditions of the playgrounds. So we're having this situation here with regards to the public schools. I'm not really sure if it's in regards to the charter schools as well. Even though charter schools are public schools, they operate a bit differently in terms of people being able to intercede or get in the middle of or intervene in their operations. But here we have them basically saying that the state actors got involved and they made the situation worse. Count three, also under the exact same clause, alleges disparate treatment on the basis of race in violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Now, the Equal Protection Clause comes right after the Due Process Clause, and it's basically saying not only can you not deprive a person of life, liberty, or property without due process, but you also cannot deny to any person equal protections under the law. And that means exactly what it sounds like it means. Everybody Every citizen of the United States is afforded the same legal protections as every other citizen. So in this point, and point three, they're basically saying that we aren't getting the same treatment as other people are getting. And they're saying that it's because of their race. The schools, I believe most of the schools represented are predominantly black, over 80-90% black. One of the schools is predominantly Latino, and that's why they're saying people of color instead of just black people. But they are saying that no other schools are being treated the way that they're being treated, and they're making that claim, and they're saying that it's because they're black schools. So count four is brought under Title 6 of the Civil Rights Act and related federal regulations, and alleges that defendants use federal funds to intentionally discriminate against plaintiffs on the basis of race. Pretty self-explanatory. And count five seeks a judicial declaration that defendants violated the Constitution and federal law. Now here, with a judicial declaration, that's basically a judgment declaring that the state violated the Constitution. It doesn't mean that there are going to be any penalties awarded. It doesn't mean that there's going to be anything gained. It's basically just a judge saying, yes, you violated the law, you violated the Constitution, and it can be used as a way of compelling someone to change their behavior or someone to act differently, but there are no intrinsic penalties involved in a simple judicial declaration. It's exactly what it sounds like. Now to that, the plaintiffs voluntarily dismissed counts 2 and 4. You'll recall count 2 was the claim under due process that alleges that the defendants and state actors created or increased danger. They dismissed that claim on their own. And count 4 alleged that the defendants used federal funds to intentionally discriminate against plaintiffs on the base of race. So they voluntarily eliminated that claim, which left count 1, which was they were deprived their fundamental rights, a fundamental right under the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause. Count 3, which alleged that there was basically disparate treatment on the basis of race. And count 5, which sought a judicial declaration. So you had a violation of the fundamental right, you had disparate treatment on the basis of race, and you had a seeking for a judicial declaration. Those were the three counts brought forward in this case after all was said and done. Now, the defendants, or the state, moved to dismiss the complaint on two grounds. First, they insisted that they cannot be sued. According to the defendants, the state of Michigan and its officials never operated plaintiff schools, so they are the wrong parties to sue. Moreover, the defendants contended that they are immune from suit under the 11th Amendment. Now, the 11th Amendment says that the judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States by citizens of another state or by citizens or subjects of any foreign state. Now, getting into a little bit of history, the 11th Amendment was the first constitutional amendment adopted after the Bill of Rights. And it was basically following a Supreme Court ruling in which the court ruled that federal courts had the authority to hear cases in law and equity brought by private citizens against states, and that states did not enjoy sovereign immunity from suits made by citizens of other states in federal court. So basically, the Supreme Court said that citizens do have the right to sue states in federal courts, and federal courts have the jurisdiction and the authority to hear cases brought by private citizens against the states. And the states passed the 11th Amendment kind of like in a way to check the Supreme Court and be like, no, that's not what's going down. So secondly, the defendants argue that access to literacy is not a constitutionally protected right. So the failure to provide such access cannot constitute a valid claim. They also dispute the allegation that plaintiffs have been treated differently on account of their races. Of course they do. So the very first thing the judge did was he thought about who controls Detroit schools. And the decision says that while it is true that the state has exercised significant power in the Detroit school system, there's still a question as to whether or not the state is actively controlling the schools or just supervising the schools. And the question also remains as to whether or not state-appointed actors are considered local or state level. The right to access to literacy and the right to literacy is also a chief concern that he talked about, because those phrases mean two different things. The right of literacy means that you have a right to literacy, means that there is an obligation on the part of the state to make you literate. The right of access to literacy means that there is only an obligation to provide you with the opportunity to acquire literacy for yourself, or there is an obligation not to get in your way of pursuing literacy. So in terms of the schools and who owns it, the judge does mention later on that this, while the schools may or may not be actually operated by the state, the kids, the plaintiffs, the students did do a good job in proving that the people that they did sue are people who, while state employees, exhibited or exerted substantial amounts of power over the Detroit public school system. However, when we go back to that other point that we talked about, the right of access to literacy or the right to literacy, which those are two very distinct things in legal terms, it was noted that the kids are filing for the right of access, not necessarily filing for the right of literacy, but filing for the right of access to literacy. So think about, so as you're listening to this, and even those of you that go back and read the rulings, keep that in mind. We aren't talking about kids that are saying that it is, or from the brief anyways, we're not talking about kids that are saying that it is your responsibility to make me literate. We're talking about kids that are saying it's your responsibility to provide access and to not prevent me from being literate should I choose to do so. So the next point of contention here is the issue of standing, whether or not the kids even have standing to pursue a federal court case. Now, the Constitution limits federal court's jurisdiction to cases and controversies, and a plaintiff's standing is an essential and unchanging part of that, of the case and controversy requirement. And for that reason, the party invoking federal jurisdiction bears the burden of establishing three elements: injury in fact, casual connection, and redressability. Now, injury in fact is an invasion of a legally protected interest, which is concrete and particularized and actual or imminent, not conjectural are hypothetical. So the plaintiff has the burden or the responsibility for proving that they are in fact injured in a way that is legally protected. They also have the responsibility of proving causal connection or traceability, which requires the complaint of injury to be fairly traceable to the challenged action of the defendant and not the result of independent action or of some third party not before the court. So basically, you got to prove that this person punched you in the face. You can't say that they punched me in the face, but they punched me in the face because somebody else had control of their arm, and you're not suing the person that had control of their arm. So that's what they mean by traceability. And finally, redressability means that it is likely and not merely speculative that the injury will be redressed by a favorable decision. This means that whatever happened can be fixed by a judgment. So you can't sue somebody, or you don't necessarily have standing if a positive judgment wouldn't change anything. So that's the other point here. So all of those have to do with standing. Now, the state argued that the kids lack standing because they haven't demonstrated an invasion of any legally protected interest, asserting that literacy is not a legally protected interest. They also claim that they have not shown injury that is concrete or particularized or even actual or imminent. And the judge wrote with regard to that, that a plaintiff who alleges a violation of his right to due process states a legally protected interest, and the kids did that. This is set in motion because while in the standing stage, dismissing a case before it's even heard is a violation of due process. Now, that means that basically just what it said. If you try to dismiss a case before the case is even heard, that is a violation of due process, and due process is in of itself a legally protected thing. Now, the courts also disagree with the state saying that the kids had not pled a violation that is concrete, particular, actual, or imminent. And the judge wrote that their school buildings are replete with conditions that make learning nearly impossible and provide photographic evidence. They also alleged that their schools lack teachers and materials necessary to attain literacy. And with regards to traceability, the court recognized that the kids had identified each of the defendants' roles in the state and how their positions related to the operation of Detroit schools. Finally, the state argued that there was no redress as some of the kids no longer attended the schools that they claimed, and their new schools aren't filed as part of the case. But the court ruled that the kids were arguing for access to literacy, not literacy itself, and that the things that they are asking for will provide access to literacy, thus making the redress portion of the kids' standing permissible. Not only that, but the courts went further by saying that only two of the kids were in that category that the state had identified as not having standing. So even if you remove those two children, you still have other kids in the class action lawsuit that are there, and they still have standing. So the case can continue forward. Now, the state also sought immunity under the 11th Amendment, but the judge basically said that the state or its actors were not immune from this particular suit because it is a conduct suit, not seeking monetary gain or retroactive activity. They're simply asking for a judicial declaration compelling Michigan officials to comply with the Constitution and federal law. Now, the Rooker-Feldman doctrine was also used by the state in order to get the case dismissed before being heard by the judge. But the judge rejected that, saying that it was simply not applicable to this case. Now, the Rooker-Feldman doctrine basically says that the federal courts don't have jurisdiction of state court decisions when used to try to reject the state court's judgment. Only the Supreme Court can. But he said that it didn't apply. And they brought this up because there were previous lawsuits by members of Detroit suing the state with regards to the school, but none of those suits were under the spectrum of what this suit was. So they didn't apply. Now, the judge spent a substantial amount of time talking about fundamental rights in his opinion. And the Supreme Court, he says, the Supreme Court has repeatedly emphasized in Rodriguez and elsewhere that the importance of a good or service does not determine whether it must be regarded as fundamental. We do not denigrate the importance of decent, safe, and sanitary housing, but the Constitution does not provide judicial remedies for every social and economic ill. There is no fundamental right to receive water or sewer service. In sum, federal courts have demonstrated a reticence to find positive rights to unquestionably important necessities of life. Now, here we have to define some terms because he used the term positive rights. And so we have to talk about positive rights versus negative rights for just a second. But here we get to the, we learn that positive rights is a right that people are obliged to give. They're obliged to give me. So a positive right is the right to an attorney if I get into legal trouble, irregardless of whether I can afford one or not. If I get into legal trouble, I have the option of getting an attorney. You hear it in your Miranda rights all the time. You have an option. You have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided for you. That is a positive right. The quality of the attorney does not matter. The only thing that matters is that I am provided an attorney if I want one. Now, a negative right is a right that people are not required to stop me from getting. For instance, the right to trade or free speech is a negative right. No one can stop me from trading or from performing or speaking without a damn good reason. So you can think of positive rights as rights that people actually have to do something to afford to me. And you can think of negative rights as rights where people don't have to do anything but not get in my way. So this comes up because the case that is brought forward teeters on the line of, in terms of the plaintiff's case, teeters on the line of whether they are arguing for a positive rights standpoint or a negative rights standpoint. And that matters in terms of also when you get into solutions. But more specifically, fundamental rights are generally perceived to be positive rights. So we move forward in that now that we've talked about positive rights versus negative rights. We go back to what the judge is saying. So he says, conceivably, a case like this one could be argued on either positive or negative right theories. As a positive right, access to literacy, i.e. minimally adequate education, is so important that the state is compelled to provide it. As a negative right, access to literacy is so important that the state may not hinder plaintiffs' attempts to secure it. The complaint alleges that each plaintiff was denied access to literacy and repeatedly speaks of the denial to access to literacy. In a sense, the phrasing evokes the notion of a barrier. The defendants have kept plaintiffs from accessing literacy, and but for defendants' obstruction, plaintiffs could and would have the access. In other words, the allegations state the violation is of a negative right. The violation of a negative right is not what the complaint truly seems to argue, however, the judge continues. The complaint explains in great detail that the instruction and resources in plaintiff schools are inadequate. The plaintiffs aver the state is the entity responsible for securing and ensuring the plaintiff's opportunity to access literacy, yet have failed to ensure a basic environment for teaching and learning that is the necessary prerequisite for the acquisition and transmission of literacy. Moreover, the judge continues, the Supreme Court's understanding of a fundamental right requires finding that neither liberty nor justice would exist absent state-provided literacy access. That finding is difficult to square with the fact that there was no federal or state-run school system anywhere in the United States as late as 1830. So basically what the judge is saying here is that the Supreme Court has said that a fundamental right is a right that would exist absent of the state. Regardless of the state enforcing the right or not, the right would exist. And he goes on to say that literacy or access to it does not fall within that realm, does not fall within that understanding. And then he goes on to say that there were no federal or state run schools anywhere in the United States as late as 1830. So school districts at the time of the Constitution's ratification were formed when a group of farms came together and decided to construct a public building for schooling, where their children could gather and be taught reading, writing, and moral codes of instruction. The history evinces a deep American commitment to education, but runs counter to the notion that ordered society demands a state-provided one. The conclusion that education is not a fundamental right is arguably implicit even in Brown versus the Board of Education. After the court explained the inestimable importance of education in American life, it couched its holding in the following terms. In these days, it is doubtful that any child may reasonably be expected to succeed in life if he is denied the opportunity of an education. Such an opportunity, where the state has undertaken to provide it, is a right which must be made available to all on equal terms. Now, the holding is certainly instructive on the plaintiff's equal protection claim, but on the narrow matter of substantive due process, it points the other way. A state could have chosen not to undertake the provision of the education at all. And again, we'll go back up. It says that such an opportunity, where the state has undertaken to provide it, is a right. So that's what he's talking about when he says that. Now, the judge, his findings, the conditions and outcomes of plaintiff schools, as alleged, are nothing short of devastating. And this is what the judge is writing. When a child who could be taught to read goes untaught, the child suffers a lasting injury, and so does society. But the court is faced with a discrete question. Does the due process clause demand that a state affirmatively provide each child with the defined minimum level of education by which the child can attain literacy? Based on the foregoing analysis, the answer to the question is no. Number one, burden of fundamental right. The court has already concluded that the due process clause does not require a state to provide access to minimally adequate education. In other words, access to literacy is not a fundamental right, at least not in the positive right sense. And remember, when we're talking about fundamental rights recognized by the Constitution, most of those are positive rights. Accordingly, the state's alleged failure to provide literacy access to plaintiffs fails to state an equal protection claim on the basis of burdening a fundamental right. So what he's saying here is, access to literacy is not a positive right. It's not a fundamental right. And the kids failed, in his estimation, to adequately prove that it was a fundamental right. To point two, and these were of the 3 points that were remained after the kids voluntarily dismissed two of them. They had 5 claims. They voluntarily dismissed 2. He's going through the 3. So that was the first one. This is the second one. Targeting a suspected class. He says, although the complaint clearly establishes that plaintiff schools predominantly serve children of color, 4 of the 5 schools are at least 97% African-American, and the 5th is 31.1% African-American and 64.2% Latino. It makes no claim about the relevant comparator schools. The only specific reference to the racial makeup of other schools is to the Grosse Pointe, which has not experienced the relevant state interventions. The complaint opines that the conditions in plaintiff schools would be unthinkable in schools serving predominantly white affluent student populations, but it does not state any instance where defendants intervened in a school with a different racial makeup and treated that school differently. Without this type of comparison, the complaint fails to state a claim that defendants have classified or otherwise differently treated plaintiffs on account of race. So basically, they didn't present any other cases where the state intervened into a school that had a different racial makeup, say an all-white school, and did the same thing. So without that comparison of saying this is what they did to the black school and this is what they did to the white school, you can't say that it's based on race. That's legal standing. I know a lot of us that are black would be like, BS. But legally speaking, that's what it is. And to the last point that remained after they voluntarily dismissed 2 of their points, the lacking of rational basis. And basically, the judge says that There are no examples given. Not even going to get into reading all that. He basically said there are no examples given. Plaintiffs must do more than point to the present conditions as prima facie evidence that the state and defendants specifically have acted irrationally. The court accepts as true the complaint's factual allegations, but the plaintiffs must still plead facts that are more than merely consistent with defendant's liability. Basically, they didn't prove that. They didn't prove that at all. They didn't prove it at all. And even though what they said was factual, they didn't prove that it was lacking a rational basis. All right, so basically the judge said, your situation's messed up. I'm sorry, but literacy ain't a fundamental right. And you know what? I kind of agree with him. You see, and I know a lot of people are up in arms about this situation. They're screaming racism. The ACLU, the NAACP, everybody is getting geared up and they're ready to fight the power. But think about it in terms of what we were able to do in terms of educating ourselves. And think about it in terms of in 1870, 1880, more than 70% of the black community was illiterate. Illiterate. And by 1910, look at that, from 1870, by 1910, only 30% or less of the community was illiterate. And that was not accomplished by state-sponsored schools. That was not accomplished by the state itself. That was not even accomplished with official, what we would term, schools. That was accomplished by churches and by communities getting together and deciding to educate their children. That was accomplished oftentimes with kids that could only commit 2 or 3 months a year to education because they had to help their families. They had to help their fathers till the land. They had to help their mothers. They had to help their families provide. So in 2 months, kids were coming into these centers. Adults were coming into these centers, largely sponsored by churches, and becoming literate and then going back to work and passing that on. A lot of the universities, the HBCUs that we have now, were not created by state agencies, by judicial orders, by executive actions. They were created by people in the community who made a decision to educate. So even if you go back, not just in black history, but in American history, the state has never had a responsibility to providing literacy. Now, it has had a responsibility to providing equal education. But the quality of that education has always been something that's been up for debate. So I agree with him. Now, as to those that would say that, well, what about the white people? If this was a white school, this wouldn't be happening. They wouldn't have had to sue the state. You're 100% right. If this was a white school, they wouldn't have had to sue the state. You know why? Because white parents would have petitioned the local school board to create their own school district, and they would have moved their kids out of the failing school district into the school district that they had created for themselves, that they funded for themselves, and they would have taken the education of their children into their own hands. How do I know this? Because they're doing it now all over the country. Right here in Charlotte and Matthews, which is upper scale white people, they have petitioned CMS, Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, to create their own school district for their kids because CMS is failing. And we've seen it literally all over the country. They're not suing the state. They're building their own schools. And you know what? I don't even like the comparison of saying, well, white people would do this, so, you know, this wouldn't happen if white people were doing it. What does it matter? If it's inadequate, it's inadequate. But we've got to stop looking at the government to fix these problems that we can fix for ourselves. I mean, if you look at the Michigan numbers that they that the kids cited in their own plaintiff brief, they said that 45% of Michigan third graders, 45% of Michigan third graders statewide were proficient in English. Just 45%. That means over half of the people, over half of the third graders in Michigan are illiterate, functioning illiterate, not even functioning illiterate, illiterate. Why would you want the state to come and get involved? Why would you be suing the state to do better when even in the communities where the state is doing what it's what you say it's supposed to be doing, it's still failing? So the biggest takeaway from this, the biggest lesson from this screen is that if we're serious about our education, we've got to get more involved. I've never seen a failing school with an engaged community. I've never seen it, and you never will see it. The moment my kid comes home to me and says, "Hey, Daddy, for the last week, we've had another teacher, another student teaching us math because we don't have a teacher to teach it," I'm up at the school. And you know what? I don't even have to be up at the school. My wife is up at the school. But I'm up at the school too because I'm not no mathematician. But you can bet your ass I'm going to be doing something so that they learn math on that day. I know math better than an eighth grader. You know what I'm saying? So we've got to stop getting in these situations and then begging the government to come get us out, begging the government to come bail us out. What is a judicial declaration going to do in the first place? It's not going to do anything. The students are being failed. Not only are they being failed by the schools, and I know a lot of people are going to push back against this, but they're being failed by their parents as well. They're being failed by their communities as well. The fact that there are so many of the seniors, the 18-year-olds in that school that can't read, they're talking about in the plaintiff's brief, they have 18-year-olds that can't read monosyllabic words. That means they can't read words with one syllable. That means they have students asking each other, "How do you spell the?" That's not a government issue. That's a community issue. And we should all be embarrassed by that. All of us, black people everywhere, should be embarrassed by the fact that those kids are in that situation and the fact that their parents and their community feels like the best course of action to repair the situation is to sue the state instead of getting involved in the schools. So with that, I bid you adieu. I thank you for listening to the show, and I'll see you next week on the next episode of Lessons from the Screen.
Lessons from the screen, what we mean is we go through different documentaries to tell you what they gon' do. Give you our lessons, give them our blessings. If they trash, we tell you there is no second guessing. Knowledge is power, but time is precious. And we're here to keep you from them lessons. So sit back as we groove, giving you the review, so you only spend time on the docs that you need to.
Once again, I want to thank you for tuning in to Lessons from the Screen. Lessons from the Screen is brought to you by PacSync. Through the Freedom Train Network, you can find us on www.freedomtrainradio.com or on iTunes, Google Play Music, or Stitcher. Be sure to head to one of those places and leave us a review, and then be sure to head back to the website to let us know what you think about the show and communicate with us. Also, be sure to head to www.packsync.org and show some love and support for our sponsors. PacSync is doing big things in the community and trying to do more, always trying to do more. So be sure to head to the website. That's www.pactsinc.org. Donate, volunteer, become a member, talk about it, whatever. They can use your support. And once again, they are doing great things in the community. And as always, Lessons from the Screen has a frame of reference and perspective that is aligned with that of the black community. The things that we look at, whether it be on the Trending Tuesday or the regular Lessons from the Screen show, will always be looked at from the black perspective. So keep that in mind, because we need more minds shaped into that perspective and trying to do things that we need done for ourselves. So with that in mind, again, thank you guys for listening. And remember to tune in to the Freedom Train Radio. We have the app. that's available that you can get from the website. It's in the Google Play Store. Sorry, it's not available on iTunes yet. We have the Live Internet Radio, and we have more shows coming up. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And I will see you guys on Thursday for the next episode of Lessons from the Screen.